When the sun rose this morning, I was laying down across my bed. When the sun rose this morning, I was laying down across my bed. Now I didn't have nobody to hold my aching head.
From Belzoni, Mississippi, that's the much-loved and revered Pine Top Perkins, Joseph William Perkins, a legend in the world of blues piano with Pine Top's Blues. It's from his 2012 album, Heaven. In 2001, at the age of 97, Pine Top Perkins became the oldest person in history to receive a Grammy. He died on March the 21st that year. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. Late Friday, workers at Ford Motor Company voted to approve a new four-year contract, bringing to a close a tense round of negotiations between the Big Three, including General Motors and Fiat Chrysler Automobiles, and the United Auto Workers Union, which represents more than 141,000 workers in the industry. We are fortunate to have with us again today Alex Wassell. He is a member of UAW's Local 869. And Alex, good to have you with us once again. Is Alex there?
Hello.
Are you there?
I'm here.
With us?
Yes.
Oh, good. Good to have you with us. Well, the last time we talked just as the vote was to be undertaken. So give us an idea of how it went.
We were talking about, I believe, the Chrysler vote, and initially the workers turned down the first Chrysler contract offer by an overwhelming majority of 65%. And subsequently, on the second vote and improvements to the agreement, they passed it roughly by a 70% margin. I think that set the stage for the other two votes and agreements at GM and Ford. And I think because of Chrysler's early opposition to the agreement that was first presented, it made for much stronger agreements in the other two companies.
What was it about this particular round of negotiations? What would you say were the key victories that the workers won, or do you see it as key victories?
The first victory would be just the membership standing up and speaking out, and their ability to say no to horrendous contracts. The positive victory would be that at least we beat back the concept a little bit of two-tier workplace and got people on an eight-year progression towards top wages. Not always top benefits, no defined pension plans, but it could have been a whole lot worse, and for that I am grateful.
Well, did the fact that the members had authorized the union to take a strike, if necessary, did that strengthen the union's hand in the negotiations?
It's pretty much pro forma that the membership gives strike authorization vote to the international union, both at Chrysler, GM, and Ford. Usually how it goes. But I think what really is important this time is that the membership wanted to see some real gains this time around for companies that are making record profits, and that drove this whole process that ended Friday.
So the key issue has been resolved. Then the key issue was this two-layered process by which workers hired before 2008, I believe, were paid at a particular rate. Workers hired after that were paid at a lower rate, and there was a great deal of reaction on the part of the workers to this two-tiered system, and that, you think, has been rectified through the contract. And what happens now? Is there just one rate of pay, regardless of when workers are hired?
Actually, it was the 2007 agreement that two-tier came into being.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But what is important is the fact that we've got a way for lower-tier workers to gain top wages. Unfortunately, it takes an eight-year process to do that, which many people, myself included, think that's wrong. And it doesn't really get rid of two-tier. I mean, because the new hires will then become eight-year progression employees. And again, for 8 years, you're paid at a different scale than top-tier workers. So it's an improvement. Does it put the issue to bed? Absolutely not. Also in the agreement, they've expanded the use of temporary workers. So those folks are going to be another lower class worker or treated differently than everybody else. But I think it's a minor improvement and one that wouldn't have happened unless workers stood up to horrendous contracts and made their voices heard.
Could you give us an idea of what the wage structure will be in this new contract, how it differs, let's say, for the base rate of pay, and through this eight-year process, what the max will be by the time the workers have gone through this eight-year progression, as you call it?
Okay, well, there's a number of different base wages, but you know, figure to get the top tier, it takes 8 years from, we'll say, roughly a $20 base wage. And
that's $20 an hour?
Yes.
Okay.
Roughly. But the important thing to remember is that some workers, depending on what, if they're in components or, we'll say, axle workers at GM or parts depot workers at Mopar, they continue with a permanent lower wage that doesn't go away. The unfairness of the system is that it takes, for some people, they never have an opportunity to transition to top wages. And for the majority of new hires, it'll take 8 years to get there. And that's why many people oppose that.
In this process, one of the things that came pointedly to the attention of the public through media coverage especially was that the two-tiered system also expressed itself in the vote. You had the production workers versus the skilled workers. How did that work out? How did that play into the negotiations?
Okay. Basically, at Chrysler, there's very little difference in the vote with skilled trades and production workers. I think maybe a bigger issue is how, we'll say, top-tier workers voted versus second-tier workers. At Chrysler, again, I think a lot of top-tier workers voted for lower tier workers to get up to top wages. I don't know, they don't have a breakdown on that issue, but there is a little bit of tension between tiers, and that's why we have to get rid of tiers, is that some person might feel that they're being mistreated and the other person is getting a little extra. But my point of view is both top tier and in progression workers are suffering greatly, and we have to eliminate tiers simply for the union principle of equal pay for equal work. And it also helps with solidarity as the fight goes forward.
This brings to mind the issue of union leadership and what the membership position was all throughout negotiations. Basically, it wasn't a veiled threat. It was an open challenge to the union leadership to step in line with the membership. In the last round of negotiations, was that gap closed more so than when negotiations initially began?
No, I think there's still a difference between the views of the leadership and the membership. What the leadership had did was they got better at their PR and selling the contract. Obviously, once the issue was resolved at Chrysler that lower-tier workers would have a path to top-tier wages, that helped the process. But at GM, especially skilled trades, voted the contract down because obviously the skilled trades issues were not being addressed adequately, and the production workers voted for it because they like the idea of at least having the ability to go to top tier wages, but there is tension between the rank and file UAW member and the UAW leadership, and I think it's up to the leadership to try to listen to their constituents and try to understand their desires and wishes and concerns, and to try to implement those into policy. Has that happened? I'm not sure. But we'll find out as we go forward.
Do you expect that there will be a direct challenge to the leadership when the vote comes around as to who gets to continue to represent the workers?
It's very hard to challenge the international leaders because the way the system's set up. If we had rank and file voting or referendum voting for the top leaders of the UAW, I would say yes, it would be a major challenge to them. But what we have here is a delegate system where you send your delegates to the convention where they're not bound to any position. Because they use the excuse, well, I might go to the convention and find out something completely new. So I might think that changing the system to allow referendum voting is now wrong, even though all my supporters or the people who voted for me wanted that. It's pretty locked up. Usually top officials aren't even challenged for election. They are voted by acclamation, meaning that there's no candidate running against them because the administrative caucus makes sure that there are no challengers. In the last constitutional convention, one person challenged Dennis Williams for the top spot as president, and it was more of a challenge in principle because we knew going in that there's no way that he could sway the delegates, no matter how eloquent or how good his position was. So, as far as challenge, I don't know. I would only hope that the members vote for delegates that will support changing the system as is, and we'll have to wait and see. But my the way I look at it, I don't see this system changing for a while.
This issue of pay inequity has been at the root of negotiations in the last two contracts in particular. the last two four-year contracts. How long have you been trying? How long has the membership been trying to rectify this? And, of course, you know, this current contract, having addressed it, is considered a victory. But how long had this issue been in play, and how long had it been affecting the pay rates for workers?
Well, the 2007 contract, people brought in two tiers. And people have been opposed to it since 2007. I think the opposition probably sort of was muted a little bit when both GM and Chrysler went into bankruptcy, but it came back to the fore in the 2011 agreements, which Chrysler barely, or Chrysler FCA, barely passed by the membership, and not by the not by the skilled trades workers. So it's been going on for a while. It will continue to go on. It's a issue of union principle, and it's not going away.
All of this, Alex, is happening against the backdrop of what is predicted to be banner years ahead for the industry as a whole. Record profits are predicted. And could you talk about this issue being resolved in the context of the billions and billions of dollars that are expected to be produced by the very same workers in the next couple of years? What is the vision? What has been the negotiated position here that would allow this issue, this particular issue of pay inequity, that gives it a special meaning and significance?
Okay, in the context of record profits now and in the near future, the business press, or what I've read, have looked at all three UAW agreements with Ford, GM, and Chrysler FCA, and basically said that these are relatively cheap agreements, easily afforded by the respective companies. To me, to use a football analogy, is the UAW punted on second down and didn't drive forward and get better gains for the workers. As far as two tiers goes, and in progression employees, because of the extended 8-year growing period, again, it's cheap for the companies, and with expected retirement of top tier workers, and myself included, I'll be retiring in 6 months or less. They'll be replacing them with cheap in progression employees and temporary employees. So, it's a relatively cheap contract for the company. The UAW workforce, the membership of the UAW, will have to keep pushing the top leaders to get a little more equity next go around.
And I guess you just summed up what you expect to be doing in the next couple of months to continue this struggle and to continue your activism within the union.
Well, I try to stand up and speak out whenever possible, but it's going to be this generation of UAW employees that are members that will have to stand up and speak out and fight for equality and better wages and benefits. And if they do that, it will help the entire labor movement. It will help the entire economy of the U.S., and I think the world would be a better place if we could win some real gains here.
Alex Wessel, thank you so much, a member of UAW's Local 869. Thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to snuff on the new four-year contract just approved by the membership. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll take this break. When we come back, we'll talk about this thing called democratic socialism. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Well, we now switch our gears and we become politically philosophical. That is to say, we are going to examine this phrase, democratic socialism. What is it? Well, as you know, it is most associated these days with Bernie Sanders, the Democratic presidential candidate. He's been talking about it and extolling its virtues and how he basically is a proponent of democratic socialism. But we don't know what it is. He hasn't quite explained what the philosophy is. Not that he has to, but it would help so people could get a sense of what it is that they're supporting and what the guiding philosophy is of democratic socialism. So I thought it would be good to just explore this because considering that it is in play now and it is being used by Sanders to differentiate himself, not even alone from the Republican lot, but also to differentiate himself even within the context of the Democratic Party, and to distinguish himself from his opponents. So I thought we should get some idea, and we should discuss this today. What is democratic socialism? And to the degree that he defines it, is it something that you favor? Do you agree about democratic socialism being a preferred way to go about things? So, to be fair, because he is a proponent of it, we should kind of get an idea from Bernie Sanders, from his own words, what democratic socialism is. And here he defines it, of course, within the context of the election, his positions, the things that he thinks are worthy of the benefits that should accrue under his idea of this democratic socialism that he thinks would be a very valuable alternative to what we have now. So here's Bernie Sanders explaining, and as a candidate, how democratic socialism will differ from what we have now, not only from what the Republican general philosophical positions are, but also the way the Democrats are defining their philosophical approach to this election. Bernie Sanders.
When I talk about democratic socialism, what that means to me is that in the year 2015, a college degree today is equivalent to what a high school degree was 50 years ago. And what that means is that public education must today allow every person in this country who has the ability, the qualifications, and the desire, the right to go to a public college or university tuition free. Is this a radical socialistic idea? I don't think so. It exists in many countries all over the world, And you know what? Used to exist in the United States of America. We had great universities like the University of California, the City University of New York, virtually tuition-free. Democratic socialism means that our government does everything it can to create a full employment economy. It makes far more sense to me to put millions of people back to work, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, than to have a real unemployment rate of almost 10%. It is far smarter to invest in jobs and educational opportunities for young people who are unemployed than to lock them up and invest in jails and incarceration. Democratic socialism means that if somebody works 40 hours a week, that person should not be living in poverty, that we must raise the minimum wage to a living wage, $15 an hour, over the next several years. It means that we join the rest of the world and pass the very strong paid family and medical leave legislation now sitting in Congress. And I want you to think about this, and I really, you know, want you to see what goes on in our country today. It's not only that every other major country, I'm not talking about Europe or Scandinavia, virtually every country in the world, poor country, small country, reached the conclusion that when a woman has a baby, she should not be forced to be separated from that newborn baby after a week or two and have to go back to work. Making sure that moms and dads can stay home and get to love their babies is a family value that we should support. And that is why I want and will fight to end the absurdity of the United States being one of the only countries on earth that does not guarantee at least 3 months of paid family and medical leave. Democratic socialism, to me, means that we have government policy, strong government policy, which does not allow the greed and profiteering of the fossil fuel industry to destroy our environment and our planet. And it means to me that we have a moral responsibility to combat climate change and leave this planet healthy and habitable for our kids and our grandchildren. Democratic socialism means that in a democratic, civilized society, the wealthiest people and the largest corporations must pay their fair share of taxes. Yes, innovation, entrepreneurship, and business success should be rewarded. But greed for the sake of greed is not something that public policy should support. It is not acceptable to me that in the last period of time, last 2 years, 15 of the wealthiest people in this country, 15 people, saw their wealth increased in this rigged economy by $170 billion. Got it? 2 years, 15 people, $170 billion increase in their wealth. That is more wealth than is owned by the bottom 130 million Americans. Let us not forget what Pope Francis has so elegantly stated, and I quote, "We have created new idols. The worship of the golden calf of old has found a new and heartless image in the cult of money and the dictatorship of an economy which is faceless and lacking any truly humane goal." End of quote. In other words, we've got to do better than that. Not a political issue, it's not an economic issue, it is a cultural issue. We have got to stop worshiping people who make billions and billions and billions of dollars while we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country. It's not acceptable to me that major corporations stash their profits in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens to avoid paying $100 billion a year in taxes. It is not acceptable that hedge fund managers pay a lower effective tax rate than nurses or truck drivers. It is not acceptable that billionaire families are able to leave virtually all of their wealth to their families without paying a reasonable estate tax. It is not acceptable that Wall Street speculators are able to gamble trillions of dollars in the derivatives market without paying a nickel in taxes on that speculation. Democratic socialism, to me, does not just mean that we must create a nation of economic and social justice and environmental sanity. Of course, it does mean that. But it also means that we must create a vibrant democracy based on the principle of one person, one vote. It is extremely sad, and I hope all of you will pay a lot of attention to this issue. It is extremely sad that the United States, one of the oldest, most stable democracies in the world, has one of the lowest voter turnouts of any major country, and that millions of young people and working people have given up on the political process entirely. In the last midterm election, just a year ago, 63% of the American people didn't vote. 80% of young people did not vote. Clearly, despite the efforts of many Republican governors who want to suppress the vote, to make it harder for people of color and old people to participate in the political system, our job together is to make it easier for people to vote, not harder for people to vote. It is not a radical ideal, and I will fight for this as hard as I can as president, to say that everyone in this country who is 18 years of age or older is registered to vote. End of discussion. So the next time that you hear me attacked as a socialist, like tomorrow, remember this. I don't believe government should take over, you know, the grocery store down the street or own the means of production. But I do believe that the middle class and the working families of this country who produce the wealth of this country deserve a decent standard of living and that their incomes should go up, not down. I do believe in private companies that thrive and invest and grow in America, companies that create jobs here, rather than companies that are shutting down in America and increasing their profits by exploiting low-wage labor abroad. I believe that most Americans can pay lower taxes if hedge fund managers who make billions manipulating the marketplace finally start paying the taxes that they should. I don't believe in special treatment for the top 1%, but I do believe in equal treatment for African Americans who are right to proclaim the moral principle that black lives matter.
All right, that was Bernie Sanders, the self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist candidate for president running under the Democratic Party's banner. And he defined this concept of democratic socialism within the context of the campaign. The things he says that democratic socialism will bring about or will help to achieve as opposed to the natural order of things. So the question here is, number one, what is this, as you understand it from Bernie Sanders? In the examples that he has given, do you understand this concept of democratic socialism, what it's supposed to be, what is its guiding philosophy? And do we appreciate now a new set of questions that should be asked? If, in fact, you are a democratic socialist and you're following the principles, these philosophies that guide your decisions, and this philosophy of democratic socialism, whatever it is, this is where we are going today. Are you saying, or is it to be inferred, that you are basically, you have a fundamental disagreement even with the Democratic Party? If you are running as a democratic socialist, does the word Democrat mean that it is the socialist part of the party? Or as a Democrat, the philosophy of socialism that you are following? So we're going to get some things clarified today through your questions and your comments about this concept that he has just explained in the course of taking campaign positions, issue of equal pay, issue of family leave, issue of free education, issue of voting rights and Black Lives Matter, and all of the other buzzwords. He has touched on a number of so-called issues that are commonly raised within the campaign 2016. But does it put us any closer to understanding this concept and philosophy of democratic socialism? Is he truly a democratic socialist? Is democratic socialism a way, a good way to reconfigure our political thinking? All of these questions are now where we are going at 888-874-4888. Is democratic socialism, as espoused and explained by Bernie Sanders, is he even following these principles? We have to talk about these things. What is this thing, as he defines it? Is it the standard definition of democratic socialism, or is it Bernie Sanders' version of democratic socialism? Is it a reasonable amalgamation of such a philosophy, or is it a convenient way of saying politically, this is where I differ with my opponents, and these are the extras that I bring to the campaign for president in 2016 that you should appreciate. These are the values that I have. What are we to understand by this thing called democratic socialism? It is your call, and you tell me what you're thinking when you hear this, when you hear these explanations, and do you have an appreciation of what democratic socialism is? Do you have an idea based on the explanation of Bernie Sanders as to what this is? What is this philosophy? And how or if it will present a very good alternative? And therefore, we now have to ask the other questions. Why, if you are philosophically different from the Democrats in the race, why are you within the Democratic Party running as a Democrat? Why not run as a democratic socialist and get it over with? As a truly independent person with a unique and truly distinct philosophy informing your political positions. Is that a fair question in your view? Is it fair to raise the question? And I thought it would be a good idea to ask you what you think. 888-874-4888. This is political philosophy we're talking here. When people say that these are the things that inform them, and you can't argue with any of his positions, really. You know, would you say that you are against family leave, for example? Would you say you are against justice? You are against promoting things that would help the environment? You are against equal pay? I don't think so. So in that regard, I don't see that democratic socialism necessarily brings us a different perspective on things. Most people would reasonably agree with these things. But perhaps Lincoln can help us. Lincoln from New York, you're on the air.
Hi, Eugene. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So you're going to give us the definitive answer today, aren't you?
You remember, being from the Caribbean, you remember Michael Mandel had proposed democratic socialism?
Yes.
And democratic socialism, what Bernie Sanders is saying is actually kind of a very nebulous. And he's actually, because democratic socialism should actually mean that the people, there should be a great amount of subsidization. It should mean that free hospital is guaranteed, free education is guaranteed, and also it should mean that housing should be a guarantee. Democratic socialism is, in its simplified form, means that all basic needs are met, whereas Bernie Sanders is not suggesting that all basic needs are met. Because even to say that we're going to try to raise salaries, there's no guarantee that Congress is going to go along with that. You know, so democratic socialism should be about making sure that the government becomes servant of the people and government functioning as that entity that is making sure that no one is excluded from all of their basic need for existence. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening very intently to you, Lincoln.
Yes. So it, in a simplified form, it is really just making sure that all basic needs are met. And Bernie Sanders is a Democrat who is just, like you said before, just throwing out some sound bites.
So do you get a sense of what democratic socialism is, and what should be, do you get a sense that in presenting this concept, this theoretical concept of democratic socialism, the way Sanders is he also saying, is he being specific about changing, it would seem to be, a reasonable expectation to hear him talk about the fundamental changes, not what has to be done, but what is absolutely necessary to have any of these suggestions fulfilled. The radical, the thing he's been calling for, this political revolution. Are you hearing anything that sounds like political revolution?
No, it's not concrete. It's not concrete. It's just like everyone else, you know, like that, just like with the statement when Obama said change. Change sounded appealing, but it was not concrete. He didn't say how are we going to make changes and what. He didn't say what changes needed to be addressed. And I also forgot something else, too. Democratic socialism means that you're not going to stop capitalism from functioning. However, you would prevent capitalism from oppressing the people. And which means that if all basic needs are met, and because, you know, in democratic socialism, but I was interested in going back to Jamaica in a political capacity, and it was a similar idea that, like, not based upon Michael Mandel's idea, but because I believe that, you know, the government should not function as a celebrity organization, but rather solely as a servant of the people. So therefore, we have to understand that there's never going to be 100% employment, because there's most, it's like, for example, I'm also an actor, and there is never enough work for an actor. There's always going to be some people out of work. And so, therefore, the fact that people are not working have nothing to do with laziness, etc. It means that the potential labor force is always bigger than the availability of work. So in a situation where you talk about democratic socialism, you're talking about making sure that people who are victims, who would be victims of misfortune, would be taken care of. No one, democratic socialism should ensure that no one falls through the cracks. However, you still allow people to be able to function in a mild capitalistic manner, meaning that capitalism is allowed to function, but it is not allowed to oppress the people, and which is a win-win for everyone, because meaning that there, like, I hate to use the word welfare, but a system similar to so-called welfare should be introduced, where everyone is given a certain amount. You see, we all should function
like. You got us started here. Let's see how people react to what you're offering today, Lincoln, and thank you so much for calling and contributing.
Thank you. Okay,
thank you, DX. You're from L.A., and you're on the air. How are you?
Hello, Yatrice. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Now, what is this thing we just heard of democratic socialism, and what does it mean to you? How did it hit you?
Well, it didn't hit me because I've been explaining this to all of my friends for years now. Well, let's start with why they have to term it as democratic socialism. And by the way, most countries, as he alluded to in his speech, in Europe and all the countries in Scandinavian countries, such as Denmark, Sweden, Norway, they all have this system of government. Basically, it's just basically a democracy mixed with a few more socialist ideas than the ones we have. We do have socialism in this country as well.
Let me just pause here for a second, and I want to address this because this is a very important point. The point of reference, the cultural point of reference, puts me ill at ease. I don't understand why the models for socialism are constantly drawn from Europe, and that bothers me. because of the history of the interplay with things European and things like mass genocide and racism and so forth, also being scientifically developed.
So, let's start with this. Let's start with this, Utrecht. Back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, we had a socialist party in this country. The last person, I believe, to run, well, not the last person, but the most famous person to run on the Socialist Party was a man named Eugene Debs. And this was back when socialism wasn't a vilified term. They vilified it by conflating it with communism, because around the world, almost every totally socialist government that has experimented with that has basically become sort of communist. China, for example, and Russia, of course, before the Soviet Union, actually, before they got broken up. But this is how they vilified this term, is what I'm saying. And now people conflate socialism with communism. They're two different things. I listened to a socialist, Professor Wolf. Do you know who he is, economist? Socialist,
yes.
Economist, Professor Rich Wolf. He makes no bones about admitting that he's a socialist. And all that means is that the people control... Well, when you're talking economics, companies, and so forth, the people control the means of production. That's all that means. So the organization is a bottom-up structure instead of a top-down structure. That's all it means. So the reason why Bernie Sanders is using this term democratic socialist is because the word socialist has been vilified for so many decades, and you can't come out and run for office and say you're a socialist. People will conflate that with communism, which means the government controls just about everything. You see what I'm saying? So this term here is used to soften up the ideas. But as I was saying earlier, we have socialist concepts in this country already. The fire department, the public library, the police department, public schools. But you don't want to call it that, because people... But I agree with everything he said there in that speech. Those are the things we need in this country. Do I think it will ever happen? No, it's too far gone now. The government is basically being run by corporations, and whoever has the money controls things. Unless we get
like I said,
the
I don't
money
disagree.
Out of politics, it
I
won't
mean,
happen.
I, and I agree with you. I think the... You can't. It's hard to make a case against any of the things that he said that need to happen.
Right.
But that's not the issue. The issue is this democratic socialism, and is this going to happen? These things that he's proposing, are these things possible within a system that is set, that is not democratic, that is not socialist? So is he selling a pipe dream?
Well, I don't think he's selling a pipe dream. I think he's just trying to get his ideas out there. I don't think he'll be elected, because this country is way too far gone on the money side of politics. But you know what? Well, know something really strange before I get off the phone, Utrecht? Most of these countries in Europe, Germany and France included, who have things like paid leave and sharing of the unemployment, you know, well, I'll explain that another day, but most of these countries in Europe, they got these ideas from the United States, and the United States set these ideas and programs up in their countries after the war, the big war. So it's mighty strange that we can't have these things, but we set those things up in those countries. And that's back when, right after the war, when being socialist wasn't a big, you know, no-no to say that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't believe this will happen here. I don't believe Bernie will get anywhere near the White House, because there's too many corporations and billionaires and people like that who are going to make sure that he doesn't.
Well, thank you so much. We'll continue the conversation. This is really... a fascinating thing that we're witnessing without it being redefined. But thank you so much for your call today. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Please tell me, baby. What can I do to change your mind?